First of all, yeah, thank you that you're here. Thank you that you accepted our request. We're really, really happy because we had one conversation with a patient with mantle cell lymphoma and was really successful. For us, it's really, really important to like give patients voices, because for young physicians, in our opinion, it's really, really important to have active conversations and learn also from patient experiences that lived through all the horrors that we produce. And yeah, we really thank you for being here. First question, basic one. Your name, that's obviously not really American.
It's Szymalewski. That's my husband's surname, and it's Polish. And I'm under the understanding that if I lived in Poland, you would say the name Joleski, but so.
Okay.
Szymalewski.
And we invited you because you're a myeloma patient, and we obviously want to talk with you about that. But maybe let's start if you introduce yourself a little bit. So what did you do before your diagnosis? A bit of your like life story, bit of background that people know who you are.
Okay, I live in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. I was born in New Jersey, raised in New Jersey, and still live in New Jersey. So it's really not that bad of a place, although it gets a bad rap sometimes. I, for most of my adult life, I was a teacher. I taught both in special education classes and in regular education. Towards the end of my teaching career, I was a fifth grade math and science teacher, which was great because I love science. I'm kind of a science geek. So, you know, I think that's what also led me a little bit into the area of research advocacy. I'm married. I have a daughter. She's getting married next year. And I love animals. And we have lots of pets. And my daughter's a veterinarian. So I guess my love for animals rubbed off on her. And in 2008, I was diagnosed with myeloma. Starting probably in 2006, I was experiencing lots and lots of back pain. But most people who experience back pain don't think cancer, don't think going to a hematologist. They think, let me go to an orthopedic doctor to see what was going on. The orthopedic doctor took a look at me. I was young. I was in my 40s at the time. I was overweight. He told me to touch my toes, to do this. And he diagnosed me with degenerative disc disease. And without doing any imaging on my back, I was treated for 2 years with physical therapy and pain medication. My pain was getting worse. I thought I was intolerant of pain. I thought I wasn't doing my physical therapy the right way. Back then, I was not the patient that I am now. I was brought up in the era of doctor knows best. So I just really didn't ask questions. I was always concerned why no imaging was done of my back. You know, when I was starting to talk to people, they would say, well, you didn't have an MRI. No, you didn't have any x-rays. No. So that kind of concerned me, but I figured the doctor knew what he was doing and really never asked why that wasn't done. In retrospect, I probably should have asked questions, but finally, after about 2 years, pain was getting so bad. Being a teacher, I couldn't do a lot of my duties. I couldn't do recess duty because I couldn't stand for too long. I couldn't take my class on field trips because I couldn't stand the bumping on the bus. I mean, so finally, I went back to the orthopedic doctor in tears, and that's when he finally took an x-ray. X-ray revealed I had several compression fractures. I was told that we would go to kyphoplasty surgery to heal those fractures, you know, to stiffen up my spine. But part of the surgery required pre surgery blood work. The blood work came back abnormal. I was sent to a hematologist, and that's how I was diagnosed with myeloma. So yeah, that's my story in a nutshell.
Gosh. And following that, what happened when you immediately got the diagnosis?
Well, when I got the diagnosis, I was diagnosed by a community oncologist, and the treatment had to start immediately. By the time the diagnosis was confirmed, bone marrow biopsy revealed that myeloma was in more than 99% of my bone marrow. Was diagnosed with stage 3. I had lost 3.5 inches of height due to compression fractures. So, but once again, I wasn't the advocate I am today. It was 2008. So 2008, doublets for induction therapy were commonplace, not triplets, or now they're doing quadruplets. And so I had a choice of, you know, Rev Dex or VLK Dex, and made my decision based purely on the fact that if I took Rev Dex, which was an oral treatment, I could continue to teach. Whereas if I took VLK Dex, which at that time was an IV push twice a week, I knew I couldn't continue to teach. So I started with Rev Dex just because of convenience. Didn't know to ask about efficacy, didn't know to ask about side effects. You know, it was just like, oh, he told me these are my two choices, so they both must be good. I just never had to deal with a major health issue before. So I didn't know what questions to ask. Unfortunately, the Rev Dex stopped working probably after 2 or 3 cycles. I started it in July. By the end of October, my numbers reached a plateau, then began to climb again. They didn't do the type of genetic testing back in 2008 that they're doing today, but my FISH results didn't show high risk, but the way that my myeloma was behaving, it showed that it was more of a high risk. So we went right into a stem cell transplant. Doctors thought, you know, by this time I did have a myeloma specialist on my team, and my myeloma specialist, you know, was concerned that I had stopped responding to the Rev Dex so quickly. As I was preparing for transplant, there was a little bit of time. This was around Christmas time. They added VLK to the mix. So I was on the triplet RBD, and I had like 2 or 3 cycles of that, but it really, my numbers didn't go up, but they were more of a plateau with the RBD. So he was really still concerned. Went into transplant with a very high M spike, and 100 days post transplant, the M spike was the same thing. So I thought I was a goner. I mean, I really did. I mean, by this time I started reading and educating myself about myeloma and started joining. They had back in 2008, they really didn't have Facebook groups like they have now, but they had something called a listserv. So I joined the listserv and started learning that, you know, a lot of people had great responses to RBD, you know, and they weren't even doing transplants because their responses were so good. And like most people, after transplant came out in a complete remission or at least a VGPR. And so I was beginning to worry at that point. There wasn't all the therapies that are available now. There was no such thing as Darzalex or Pomalyst, or I mean, they might have been in trial, but they were not readily available to me. And I was thinking I would have to pursue clinical trials or whatever. So it was at that point that I decided that I had to retire from teaching. First, my immune system was compromised. But secondly, a teaching career is not something that you could say, oh, I'll take 2 days off a week and just go down to part-time, or I'm going to come in late a couple days a week, but I'll make up the time at the end of the day. You just can't do that as a teacher. First of all, there's no making up time. You have to be there when the students are. And secondly, it's not fair to your students if you're not there consistently. You can't, even though I had plenty of sick time, it wasn't fair to my students to have a substitute two mornings a week, you know, for a long, long time. So it was at that point I retired from teaching. And and from there I went back, and because there really wasn't much available. And in the meantime, like before I retired, I chose a treatment and I chose thalidomide, and which kind of didn't make sense, but I said I would give it a try. You know, like Revlimid was a newer drug and it stopped working, but my myeloma specialist said, well, sometimes thalidomide does work, you know, and it did. It worked, but it worked slowly, gave me neuropathy. So stopped it, went back on RVD for a bit just to see, so I could start exploring trials. I mean, I started getting second and third opinions. I was recommended maybe I should have a second transplant and an allo transplant, or maybe I should do this or that, you know, and they were all really scary options because they were very, very aggressive, total therapy, you know, just really, really aggressive things that I would have done, but it scared me. But kind of miraculously on the RVD, my numbers started to go down. But the way I was responding, I guess, to RVD was very atypical. Most people, you know, after a cycle, their numbers really go down, and then they go down, and maybe by four cycles, they're in a complete remission. The way I responded to RVD was, went down a notch, plateaued for a couple, went down a notch, plateaued for a couple. And this continued for over 2.5 years until I reached my maximum response. So I was very atypical in the way I was responding, which was scary to me as a patient, because I hear all these things, you know, about response, and, you know, it was a scary time. And my maximum response was always just a very good partial response. It was never a complete response. I was never MRD negative. And by this time, listening to doctors talk, by now I was more into the world of advocacy and listening to webcasts and asking questions. I wasn't that person who was afraid to ask questions back in 2008. But they were talking about you had to be MRD negative. If you weren't, that was the best predictor of prognosis. And if you weren't MRD negative, then, you know, then it wasn't the best. And that really got me worried. And I was asking my doctors, I'm not MRD negative. Shall we add something else? And they said, no, Cindy, you know, you're stable and your disease isn't progressing, so we're not going to add something else. But you keep on hearing about MRD negative and that, but never became it. But now it's almost 8 years later, and I'm still with an M spike that goes between non-observable but a faint band till 0.4. And I'm still on Velcade maintenance, and I do it once a month. So, you know, I think, you know, it was scary because I wasn't responding the way others were responding. But I guess in retrospect, I'm one of those slow responders that have indolent type of myeloma. And I wish there were biomarkers that could test my blood and say, don't worry, Cindy, you have this kind of myeloma and you don't have to be an MRD negative and you'll be responding slowly. So.
Wow. That's quite a road. We don't want to keep you always in the past, because as you told us, it must have been scary in the beginning. I mean, to receive the diagnosis. What I noticed when you talked about it, that there was this discrepancy. So you started with the diagnosis and with the insecurity. So you told it like no one talked to you about really what's going on, any strategy or any like goal they might have. I mean, we don't want to judge anyone in retrospect, of course, but it seemed that in that moment you felt this like loneliness, or you have to decide what you want to do. And then on one point you started talking about all options that exist, and which was also scary, right? Because right. Okay, what should I do with all these options then? What do you think is this reason? Is this really like a doctor's fault, the physician's fault, or because
I don't want to place blame, but I guess it was the way when I was newly diagnosed, I was diagnosed by a community oncologist. The community oncologist was older, just about ready to retire, and he was a very patronistic doctor. It was like, not patronistic, paternalistic doctor. He just would say, let me handle your myeloma, don't worry, I have this under control. He was in that way, he didn't even tell me I should go be seeing a specialist. So when I went to see the specialist, I had all this anxiety because I thought my community oncologist would get mad at me because I was seeing a myeloma specialist because he wasn't the one that recommended. Like maybe I didn't trust him, or I just felt like I was going behind his back. You know, I was a very different person, didn't speak openly. And so I think, you know, in the beginning, that's why, because I was in the community, I wasn't educated the way I should have been, and I wasn't part of that decision-making process. But when I started seeing my myeloma specialist, I started learning about what was happening. There was a long-term plan. Actually, even with my community oncologist, he said, once we get you in remission, I'll let you talk to one of my colleagues about stem cell transplant. I really don't believe in it, but I'll let you talk to one of my colleagues, which was still a community doctor, not a specialist, you know, about it. So here I'm okay, already like, I'm not going to do transplant. My doctor doesn't believe in it. And then I went to the myeloma specialist, and part of this plan was transplant and this and that. And I'm like, starting to feel like, oh my, you know, maybe what's happening here. And and over time though, it was funny because I kept that community doctor, even though I was seeing my myeloma specialist. And then I started seeing other doctors, and my community, you know, it's very common for your community oncologist to get reports from all the doctors you are seeing. So once he made some kind of comment, like, I'm getting all these reports in your folder, it's growing. It was not electronic medical records back there. You had files that were getting bigger and bigger. So the next time I went to visit him, I gave him a Starbucks card and told him that was to stay awake to read all my files. And we started developing a relationship. And by the time he retired, we had those conversations like, Cindy, what do you think is next? What do you have? You know, he realized that I was becoming educated and could be part of that decision-making process. And that actually made me feel more comfortable, because when I wasn't educated and not really part of the decision process, I was very uncomfortable because I'm thinking, well, maybe I'm doing the wrong thing. But educating myself and making that decision, I never looked back, because I always thought I made the right decision based on all the facts that I had.
Yeah, from the journey you've had and everything, you've clearly learned so much. What do you say to people now who get in touch, being the advocate you are, who are newly diagnosed, who are scared, and who are faced with all these options?
Yeah, I guess the first thing you tell them, relax for a minute. This is not a sprint, it's a marathon. So you really, this is something that, you know, you really need to prepare for. First thing, you need to be in touch with a myeloma specialist. I mean, even more so now with all of the new therapies being available, both, you know, in clinic and in clinical trials, the myeloma specialists are still figuring out how to use these BCMA-directed therapies. What comes first, what comes second? You can't expect a community oncologist to know all that. So that's first of all. But secondly, they need to educate themselves or have a family member or an advocate educating themselves, because they need to know what's going on so that they can be part of that decision-making process and ask those important questions. Tell them it's important to tell your side effects, you know, tell your doctor your goals. Join some type of support community. It could be either online support community. Now many support groups are meeting virtually since, you know, COVID through Zoom meetings. Some are meeting in person. There are Facebook groups. There are all different ways, you know, you could get a mentor or a coach if you're more comfortable talking one-on-one, but you really need to have others who are walking in your shoes to be able to talk you off that ledge when you get scared, you know, or tell you that they've been through it. You know, transplant was the scariest thing in the beginning, but I had a mentor who was like a year ahead of me in transplant, and he would tell me what's coming up, and my doctor could have told me that. My husband could reassure me, I knew, but it's not the same as someone else who's done that and survived and looked good and is talking about it. It's just very different. So I tell them to do that too, you know, and yeah, so those are important things. Educate yourself, get a specialist on your team, find support, but also live your life, you know, there that, you know, I think, and I may be wrong, but I tell them we have so many treatment options, and that I think there have been more new treatments for multiple myeloma in the last 12 years than any other cancer, and it's just continuing to evolve. So, you know, if something doesn't work, there's something else to try.
I want to ask you on that one. Because I read a piece in the American Association for Cancer Research about you. And there's this line of you, there has been so much progress in myeloma now that I knew I needed to be part of the hope. And then it continues, this was a quote, and then it continues, she understands, so you understands the importance of hope in the lives of myeloma patients. I would like to ask you on this one, because of these options, there's huge hope, yeah, but also maybe expectations, and also a bit of huge risk of disappointment if something doesn't work. What do you think, how could we mitigate this, maybe together, physicians and patients? Because obviously what you talked about was there seemed to be sometimes a huge gap between what the physician says and what you are caring about, let's say, right?
Right. Yeah, living with myeloma, and I guess I've been fortunate because my relapse and remission journey hasn't been the typical one that the myeloma patient's on, but hope is really important. You know, you don't ever want to be out of treatment options. So, I mean, having new treatments provide hope. I remember every time I attend a meeting like the AACR meeting or ASH or EHA or whatever, IMW, all these meetings, I hear doctors talking, and they're talking about things like, you know, the following year, they're talking about things I never even heard about. So that provides me hope that it's not like, oh, we got this, so we got this under control and let's stop. They're always innovating and they're always trying something new. So that's really important. But I think when doctors talk to patients, it's important to weigh the risk benefits, talk to them like this, we're hoping that this would work, but if it doesn't work, then we have these other options to try. It's always nice to let people know there's other things available, you know, and that's one thing my myeloma specialist always did from the very beginning. He always ended his report with me, you know, that patient summary report at the end with Cindy's doing well now, the do-do-do-do-do, you know, nice little summary. But if at any point she, you know, begins to relapse, these are options we could consider, including, and he would always include, clinical trials. So from the very first visit, I was introduced that clinical trials was always a treatment option. It wasn't saved to when I was out of options.
That's really interesting and good to hear. And I guess really, really good for trainees, many of whom listening to this, who may go on to specialize in myeloma. You've clearly encountered lots of myeloma specialists during your time that you've been a patient. Do you have any other advice for trainees who will likely go on to work in the field?
Well, this isn't my advice, but it's Dr. Mikhail, you know, from the IMF. He says, there's a reason why you have one mouth and two ears. You need to listen more than you speak. And I think that's important, is always give time for the patient to talk and to listen really truly to what the patient is saying. You know, there is something that as a doctor, you want to get out and you want to explain and you want to do this and you want to do that, but listen, because maybe something that that patient is saying may be a clue to what's happening with their disease, or maybe a clue to what their treatment goals would be, or maybe a clue to, well, they're not telling me about side effects, but they really must be experiencing some side effects. So I guess a trainee is listen more than you speak.
And since you mentioned it, what do you think, because you described the neuropathy problem with thalidomide in your case, obviously with new treatments, there are also new side effects. So regarding this particular point, because as you told us about transplant, is intensiveness and like side effects, these basically decide for a patient from a patient perspective what they want to do, because that's what they feel. And as with your case, response can like wait a little bit to come across to a patient. So what do you think, how should we physicians and patients like work together to make this discussion and dialogue a bit more like transparent, personalized even?
Yeah, I think doctors need to tell patients what the possible side effects are. I mean, it's really important. I don't think they need to use words like tolerable or intolerable, because unless they've had that treatment, they don't know what tolerability is. And maybe what's tolerable for you may not be tolerable for me. So I don't think we should use that, but I think they need to be said. But I also think doctors should not withhold treatments that they think the side effects are too severe. I think maybe they should tell their patients about treatments, but tell them that these are the potential side effects. And personally, I may think they're too severe, but they may be something for you. I also think it's, once again, mentoring and talking to other patients who have been through that same type of treatment. That's what was happening. That's what helped me with stem cell transplant. You know, it helped me to go into a room full of patients and say, I'm having a stem cell transplant. How was it? And 90% of the people in the room raised their hand and they were smiling after they're now walking around. So talking to others have been through the same thing, you know. Even some of the new treatments like CAR T cell therapy, CRS and ICANS feels really scary, but you might want to talk to other people who've been through it. You also, you know, there's the difference between having side effects and having side effects that can be managed. And CRS is scary, and it was really, really scary back, you know, when Emily Whitehead had it for the first time and they didn't know how to treat it. But now, you know, doctors have a pretty good handle on, you know, these are the symptoms we're looking for. These are the things that are going to be happening, and we're going to start treating with TOSI or this or that. So we can manage that. So side effects can be managed. And I think when you talk about side effects, you could also say, but we have ways that we could try to manage those side effects, you know, even with, you know, some of the ones that have pretty nasty side effects. Maybe blend wrap with the eye toxicities. That's something the patient needs to decide. And I also think when you talk about side effects, you have to make it clear whether the side effects are long-term, are they reversible? Like if you're taking a drug and the side effect is intolerable, if you stop that drug, will the side effect go away? I mean, that's something that patients might not ask, but something you should be telling that patient, you know, or the side effects something that are damaging your heart and damaging your liver and they're not reversible? Or is it a reversible neuropathy or is it an irreversible neuropathy? So these are, you know, there are side effects, but patients might not know what questions to ask. Can they be managed? Will they go away if I stop the drug? Are they reversible or are they irreversible? You know, so they're all different types of things.
I think you've mentioned it like a number of times, how myeloma is a completely different diagnosis to receive today in 2022 compared to back in, I think it was 2006, you said, originally. Right. Obviously, over that time, there have been so many new treatments come through, and the landscape is evolving all of the time. I think much is said about the cost of these new therapies and the cost and how access varies between people living in different settings. What do you think about cost of all these new therapies and stuff?
Yeah, that's a tough question. You know, I'm not an economist. You know, it's scary, you know, the cost of treatment. It's nice to know that many of the pharmaceutical companies do have patient assistance programs, that at least here in the United States, you know, but it's still very, very costly. And, you know, it may not be a cost directly to the patient sometimes, but it's a cost to the entire healthcare system. And I'm not the best person to ask, you know, like if there's a treatment that's available to me, that may be available for me, and it has the potential to put my myeloma in a remission, maybe curative or, you know, really good remission, and it costs a lot of money, I still want to try that treatment. Whereas it maybe like we have people here in the United States called ICER who tell me whether or not that is cost effective. You have qualies over there in Europe, you know, and, you know, I can't solve that world problem, but it makes me sad to know that in certain countries, there are very effective treatments not available to patients because they're costing too much and the government refuses to approve them as a treatment in that country. So, you know, I think something needs to be worked out. I just don't know what, that's not my expertise, but, you know, the treatments need to be accessible and they're not being accessible because of cost or because of where people live or, I mean, even here in the US, I mean, CAR T therapy might not be accessible to people who don't live near a center, you know, or sometimes doctors make a decision that maybe they're like a community oncologist, because what I've read, and I don't know if this is true or not, but they say most, like 80% of myeloma patients are being seen by a community oncologist. So a community oncologist may not be referring their older patient to a treatment center thinking, oh, they can't handle that, or that's too much for them, or that's too much for their family. So they're not getting access to it. But when I'm talking to doctors who are actually doing the CAR T procedures, they're saying they're going through with 80 and 90 year olds, and that CAR T sometimes is less evasive than a stem cell transplant. So I don't know, it's a big issue, and you know, disparities too becomes another issue, and we probably could have a whole show on that.
Did you also have conversations where people ask you how they could get access to CAR T? Because I think obviously we are all not economists, and we can only like try to extrapolate it, but we can't really judge it. On the other hand, what we could talk, what you just did, is like access. If people are interested or like try to inform themselves about it, and they see, okay, there's CAR T, let's say, here in Germany, and I think it's true for all Europe, there is a list in every hospital for patients and for slots, which is kind of a weird name for this therapy. And they're waiting, right?
Yeah, and it's same things here in the States. It's scary. I mean, like, I talk to doctors, and it's kind of like the transplant list. Like, you know, where are you on the heart transplant list? And yeah, how do you weigh those options? I'm hoping that improves over time. I hear, and I may be wrong, they're saying those accessibility is because of those viral vectors, and they were using them for the COVID vaccines, and just like everything else, there's a shortage of them. So, you know, hopefully companies start making their own, and I don't know, but yeah. So even if people have the insurance and live close to the hospital and want to go through with CAR T, they can't be guaranteed that they have a slot.
Mm-hmm. Are you somehow involved in discussions or trials or trial developments or all some kind of these interventional discussions? Is your patient network involved in this, or do you think it should be involved?
Yeah, I am. There are patients. Many of the pharma companies have, at least here in the United States, because I know in Europe, talking to patients is a little bit different, I guess, depending on which country you live in. Like sometimes pharma companies can talk to patients. Sometimes they could talk to patients, but not about specific drugs. I mean, each country has its own type of rules about the division of pharma and patients. But in the US, we can talk to it. And I'm on a few patient advisory boards where we talk about unmet needs and what can be done and what should they be looking at. So I've been involved in conversations over the years. I mean, even before, I mean, CAR Ts were launched or other drugs, you know, what type of education needs to be out there, what type of access needs to be out there, things like that. So, yeah, and it's not just me. There's a group of, you know, I guess the patients that you really need involved in those discussions are more of your advocates who have a greater understanding of what's involved and what drugs are available and what are just, it's just not for your typical patient who was diagnosed with myeloma, who was like me back in 2008, who just followed doctor's orders.
And when we come back at the end to you yourself, so you lived now for 14 years with it.
Yes.
How does it feel? Is there this constant anxiety, or do you can like isolate from these thoughts, or?
Yeah, you know, for the longest time when I was newly diagnosed, it was, I couldn't go on with my life until I was in a complete remission, you know, and that never happened. But as time progressed, and as I was in longer and a longer remission, that started, I could live my life. There was a time where I wasn't going to buy concert tickets for a concert that was 6 months away, not knowing what's going to happen in 6 months. Now I'm planning a year away, you know, what I'm going to be doing. And I would plan 2 years out. So my mind has changed based on a few things. I think, first of all, because my disease has been very stable. So I haven't had that roller coaster ride. You know, I've hit this plateau, and I really don't have to worry as much as other patients who are on, you know, constantly relapsing or remission. So that's allowing me to do the advocacy work that I do with a different hat on. Like, yes, I'm a patient, and I understand how patients feel, and I talk to patients every day. But when I'm doing my advocacy work, or I work for Health Tree and I develop patient materials, I develop them as a teacher, almost as opposed to a myeloma patient. You know, I can separate that, and I think I could separate that just because I've had such a good response. And also because there's so many things available. I know I'll be devastated when I relapsed. I know, because in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, oh, I've gone this long without relapsing. It's never going to happen. But I know it will. I know it will at some point. And I know I'll be devastated, but I know there's so many things available to me that provide me with hope that I could go on happily. And I that's what I tell newly diagnosed patients that I mentor, is that, you know, there is hope. This will probably work, and probably work for a very, very long time for you. But if it doesn't, there's other things available. That wasn't true back in 2008. You know, we were told that you just had all these little chocolates in the box and you had to pick and choose, you know, and you saved some therapies for later on because you needed to save. Like, you did sequential therapies. You didn't do these combinations usually, you know. Now they don't care. Do the quads up front, because if you do the quad up front and you relapse, well, we might have a bite or a car or who knows what else later on down the lane. So, yeah.
You mentioned at the start as well your family. What role have your family played in all of this and supporting you through everything you've been through?
Yeah, in the beginning, obviously, I really needed a caretaker for my physical needs, to drive me places during stem cell transplant afterwards, you know. So they were there to support me and to help me with that. And now they support me in a different way. They allow me to do all my advocacy work, you know. They're there to take care of my animals, my pets, you know, so that I could travel to a different meeting or to a different conference to learn different things, so I could include them in the educational materials I make, you know. They're there to support me, you know, to come with me to appointments if there's going to be a treatment decision made. I don't need them to come with me to get my monthly Velcade sub-Q shot. I mean, that I've been doing for 10 years. There doesn't need, but if there comes a time, I know they would be there, you know, or to drive me, to support me when we have different difficult decisions to make, and to allow me to do what's making me happy, you know, to travel and to learn and to do things so I could, you know, incorporate them into my Health Tree University. you have to check it out, HealthTree University. Have you checked it out?
Yeah, I actually did. And from the EBMT, we will hopefully put out a position paper on CAR T-cell therapy on access and affordability. And there we have a beautiful list of resources, and HealthTree is right on the top.
Good, good. Yeah. Next time I'm at a conference and you guys are there, we'll have to interview you to be faculty on one of our conferences, you know.
Definitely.
Actually, HealthTree is going to be doing a patient roundtable in Hamburg.
Ah, when?
I will have to get back to you, but yeah. I will tell you when. I'm one of our the people that are doing the roundtable.
You need to come to Hamburg. It's beautiful.
Yeah, I don't know if that's in the budget, but I did get to Austria for, you know, the EHA meeting, so that was really beautiful. But
well, Vienna is beautiful, but I won't mention anything more. But Hamburg is also very beautiful and very, very shiny, and a lot of water. If you like water, come here.
Okay, I may have to say I need to go. You need someone else to help you. But yeah, we're doing it in the fall. I will send you the details.
Yeah,
I just don't remember them. Yeah.
So that we are very happy to share any links to HealthTree, obviously, after that. And we want to thank you for your time.
And thank you.
For your energy and for all your stories. And we really appreciate it.
At any time.
Yeah. Have a good day. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hopefully see you soon.
Alrighty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.